My wife and I visited Dover earlier this year. In addition to hiking along the tops of the famous White Cliffs, we went to Dover Castle, which dates back to the time of our friend from a few episodes back, Henry II, and his boys, Richard and John.
All of Britain, half of France, I'm the greatest power in 1,000 years, and after me comes John.
So, Dover Castle. What I expected was an afternoon of throne rooms and court intrigue, and yeah, sure, there was some of that. But to my surprise, that's not where English Heritage, which maintains the site, has been putting all their money. The castle is very nice, of course, if a bit sparse on the interactivity front. It looks like the exhibits haven't gotten a lot of love in a decade or two. Which actually makes sense, because that's about how long they've been developing a state-of-the-art immersive experience in the chalk tunnels that run through the cliffs under the castle. You can only go down into the tunnels with a tour guide, for safety reasons, and there's a sizable line of people waiting for the next tour. There always is. In our tour group, there's a couple cosplaying like it's the 1940s. She, with bright red lipstick and those victory curls in her hair. He, in a hat and a waistcoat. Which seems a bit out of place among the stony ruins of the 12th century, until we descend into the tunnels. Down there, a few stories underground were taken from room to room by our guide, and we interact with extremely effective displays that describe World War II from 1939 until June of 1940. From appeasement to war, from Chamberlain to Churchill, from advantage to severe disadvantage. As an amusing touch, we're told over the loudspeaker to move, move, move from room to room by a brusque officer type. Outside of podcast world, I work as an instructional designer. I design training for software companies, so professionally, I'm in awe at the creativity down here, the discipline that's gone into illustrating these complex historical concepts like troop movements and types of tanks and planes succinctly and engagingly. As training on World War II, this is aces. When it's all over, when we've seen the last of the films projected on the walls of the tunnel, and the sounds of diving Messerschmitts and falling bombs quiet, we're free to explore the adjoining rooms on our own. These rooms are the reason that Dover Castle, Henry II's pride and joy, has become a nexus of World War II tourism.
We're down here under Dover Castle in the Napoleonic casemates, built around 1800 as barracks. They were reoccupied at the start of the Second World War.
These are the rooms where it happened, where Admiral Bertram Ramsay and his staff spent 9 days coordinating Operation Dynamo.
The great thing about coming to Dover Castle, that here in the tunnels, you'll be able to experience and feel the atmosphere for yourself, what it was like for Vice Admiral Ramsay on the 26th of May, 1940, when that message came through from the Admiralty, ordering him to start the evacuation of Dunkirk.
Now, I'll admit, I'd never heard of Bertram Ramsay or of Operation Dynamo when I descended into the cliffs. But I had heard of the French town that they all had their eyes on down there from May 26th to June 4th, 1940.
Dunkirk.
The evacuation of Dunkirk. What I knew about Dunkirk, I knew from the movies. A big set piece in the 1943 Best Picture winner.
As you know, British expeditionary forces trapped between the enemy and the sea. 400,000 men are crowded on the beaches, under bombardment from artillery and planes. Their only chance to escape annihilation rests with you. Your destination is Dunkirk.
An audacious 5-minute tracking shot from 2007. And of course, a tense trailer for the next Mindbender from Christopher Nolan.
You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
You should be at home.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Turn it around!
So essentially, yeah, I didn't know much. But of course I didn't. I'm an American. Welcome back to Iconography, a podcast dedicated to the geography of icons, real and imagined. This is part one in a two-part series on Dunkirk. Yes, I'm absolutely capitalizing on the buzziest movie of the moment, because while Dunkirk has got your attention, while you're curious about this stranger-than-fiction underdog story, and really, while you're thinking about 1940, this entire dramatic year in world history that's treated as mere prologue in our history textbooks to Pearl Harbor.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
While you're on the hook, thanks to Chris Nolan,
there are 400,000 men on this beach.
Let's talk about Dunkirk. Not how it actually happened. I'll save that for next time. This episode, no, well, actually, only this many little ships were piloted by civilians. No. No nitpicking about inaccuracies. I will pick no nits, and I will check no facts. For now. Let's talk about Dunkirk as it's been imagined, interpreted, fictionalized. The Dunkirk of myth and legend and story. We're seeing quite a spike in stories about Dunkirk this year. It's not just Chris Nolan.
He's coming back round!
Maybe it's because the last veterans of Dunkirk and the subsequent Battle of Britain, the ones who know what happened not through footage but through lived experience, are in their late 90s now, so close to leaving us. Maybe we're making one last push to connect? Three films in one year. Their Finest, a comedy about propaganda filmmakers tackling Dunkirk, from Danish director Lone Scherfig.
Mrs. Cole, where is she?
Cut! Could someone please get Mr. Hilliard out of Dunkirk?
Nolan's tense thriller.
Where are we going? Dunkirk.
And, coming out at the end of 2017, a biopic of Winston Churchill set during the fall of France.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister.
The Germans have encircled 60 British and French divisions.
We are looking at the collapse of Western Europe within the next few days.
That Churchill film, The Darkest Hour, is helmed by Joe Wright, who is no stranger to the Battle of France of May and June 1940. Not because he lived it, he wasn't born for another 30 years. No, but you could argue, part of me really wants to argue, that in 2007, in one-fifth of his second feature film, Atonement, Joe Wright created the definitive Dunkirk experience that Christopher Nolan never stood a chance. I have my own feelings about what the best Dunkirk story is. I have thoughts on thoughts on thoughts. I kind of wanted to come in here with the hottest of hot takes, claiming maybe Nolan's Dunkirk isn't even the best Dunkirk film of the year so far. What if the nowhere near as buzzy Their Finest is secretly the better film? But ever since I saw Nolan's Dunkirk, I haven't really wanted to pit the various Dunkirks against each other. Instead, I've been imagining how they would all fit together into this grand panorama of Dunkirk. A tapestry of stories stitched together. If you could only learn about Dunkirk from the stories that have gravitated towards it, if you could only learn about it from Mrs. Miniver and Atonement and The Snow Goose, the novels and the films, and from Their Finest and The Battle of Britain and the Dunkirk movie that was made in 1958 and the Dunkirk movie that just came out, if that's all you had, what could you learn? Would you understand how the French army, supposedly the world's supreme fighting force, bolstered by the Belgian army and the British Expeditionary Force, and by a supposedly unbreakable border fortification, the Maginot Line, would you be able to understand how they fell to the Germans in 1 month? Would you be able to explain how the 30,000 BEF troops that British High Command hoped optimistically to be able to evacuate before the Nazis closed in turned into 300,000 men, British and French alike? If you only had those stories, what could you learn? And what would you learn about Britain, about France, about Nazis, about soldiers and civilians, about war, peace, victory, defeat, and humanity. The magic of Nolan's film, which you should see if you haven't because I'm gonna spoil it, and a whole bunch of other stories about Dunkirk, the magic is that it's comprehensive in ways war films usually are not, while also being very restrictive in ways that war films almost never are. We never really see the home front. We never hear about the gal back in Liverpool that Johnny needs to get back to. We never see Churchill or Halifax or Gort or Ramsay pushing pegs into maps in a bunker. But we see so much. By squashing and stretching his timeline so they all fit together, so that 1 hour in the air gets as much screen time as 1 week on the beach, Nolan gives us deep dives into three disparate sets of characters. The soldiers waiting for rescue at the mole.
They've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
The sailors making their way across the sea.
Ready on the stern line.
And, usually neglected when it comes to Dunkirk, the pilots patrolling the air.
One of ours!
The time we spend with these guys, and yeah, they're all guys, is engrossing. Mark Rylance's quiet heroism as Mr. Dawson, the civilian boat captain, is inspiring.
We have a job to do.
Young Fionn Whitehead gets into daunting scrape after daunting scrape as Tommy, one of thousands of kids in the British Expeditionary Force looking for a ticket out of hell. Tom Hardy's sortie in a Spitfire as Farrier is breathtaking.
I'm on him.
It all feels immersive, especially in IMAX. But I'm having a wider screen experience when I watch Dunkirk. I imagine what's just on the periphery. Who else, besides Mr. Dawson, is setting off from England in a little dinghy? Who's up in the air, monitoring fuel readings alongside the self-assured Royal Air Force pilot, Farrier? And who is ducking the Luftwaffe amidst the dunes of Dunkirk with the baby-faced private, Tommy? From the other side of the dunes, you hear a joyous shout.
I can smell the sea.
It's Robbie Turner. Dazzling blue eyes, gray complexion. Is he all right? He's flanked by two companions. They've been separated from their unit. Seems like everyone on this beach has been. No matter, they're overjoyed to be rejoined with their comrades, with a way home so close at hand.
It's not something out of the Bible.
Hope quickly turns to disillusionment.
Jesus Christ.
There's no plan.
Just arrived, sir. Can you tell us what we're supposed to be doing?
Nothing, just wait.
Where are the ships?
A few made in yesterday, Luftwaffe blew them to buggery. Lost 3,000 men when they sank Lancaster. High Command, in his infinite wisdom, is denying us air cover.
This is chaos. Horses shot.
That's not right.
Men drunk and destroyed, hanging off the amusement park rides. But a group of men have gathered together on the bandstand to sing. Somewhere out there in this chaotic scene, Corporal Tubby Bins leads his ragtag bunch of men as they search for a boat.
Will, what do we do now?
You've got the stripes, Tubby. You tell us.
Tubby never wanted those stripes on his shoulder.
I never wanted the blasted stripes in the first place.
Too late now, Tubby. You're stuck with them.
He's not a leader of men, but the men following him now... Tell me if you've heard this one. Separated from their unit. Lieutenant Lumpkin got killed not long after the retreat order, and these guys needed a leader. And Tubby has led them, bravely, if reluctantly, through multiple harrowing scrapes with the Germans.
Get him, Prince!
A close call on a road filled with refugees. a shootout in an abandoned farmhouse. Stealthy tiptoe through the middle of a German camp.
Gotta leave a scalpel to the dummies, eh?
Yeah, that's how many Schweine fall for dick.
And now they're here, on the beach, like Robbie Turner, like Tommy. Waiting. Hoping. Tubby's men push and shove their way down the crowded mole, finally find their way onto the ship.
We were lucky. We just made it.
And it's flat calm at that.
I should be sick just the same.
Well, you can't.
I could be sick on Finsbury Park Lake. I have.
Relief. Turns to terror. And they're back on the beach. How are all these men gonna get off this beach? This damn shooting gallery where the Germans can just shoot fish in a barrel.
Get your head down. Come on, son.
I don't want to die. I don't want to die.
You might have to.
I don't want to die.
You might bloody well have to, chum.
Call the stretchers over. Robbie Turner, wandering the abandoned town now. He's wounded, too. Badly. A shrapnel wound that's getting infected.
Look, you sure you're feeling all right?
Never better. Now I'm wondering whether the beach really is the best place for dinner.
He's starting to lose touch with reality.
No, it's further on. What is this place I know? An old cottage with white clapboards and blue painted window frames.
Oh, yes. That's right, that's where we're going.
It's close to here.
One feverish thought consumes him. Return home to Cecilia Tallis. Let's go back with him 5 years to a time, it seems, centuries ago. Peacetime. The night Robbie and Cecilia confessed their love for each other. And consummated it too. Robbie was packed away in the back seat of a police car, accused of a rape he did not commit, by Cecilia's precocious little sister, Bryony.
Find you. Love you. Marry you. And live without shame.
I love you. Come back. Come back to me.
1940 again, London. Bryony is 18 now.
Dear Cecilia, please don't throw this away without reading it. As you'll have seen from the notepaper, I'm here at St. Thomas's doing my nurse's training. I decided not to take up my place at Cambridge.
Is this Bryony's penance? Her atonement? She knows now that she was wrong. A silly little girl playing pretend. Or worse, was there malice there? Jealousy that Robbie wanted Cecilia and not her? The guilt is eating away at Bryony Tallis. At night, she types and types and types the story of Robbie and Cecilia, hoping that it will have a happy ending. One day, a long, long time from now, she'll give them that happy ending. It will be a lie. Boats pass below Bryony's window at St. Thomas's, pass right between her window and Big Ben on the other side. So many boats. Little, tiny boats. Fishing boats and pleasure yachts and tugboats. Past her, out under Tower Bridge, and then to the Thames Estuary, where they meet up with more boats from all across the coast. Can these boats really be going to Dunkirk? All the way across the channel with the Luftwaffe strafing them from the sky? That one over there, the Nancy Starling, that one won't. It's already broken down. But let's focus on this broken-down boat for a moment anyway, just to give us an idea the kind of people who are making this impossible journey. Two teen girls, twins, Lily and Rose Starling, heard what was happening in Dunkirk and they took their father's boat. He doesn't know. If he did, he would probably hurt them. Again. Lily and Rose will never see Dunkirk. But so many of the boats passing them will. My God, how many of them are captained and manned by civilians? Small town blokes looking to do their part, get those hundreds of thousands of men back home. How's this even possible? How's the Navy even okay with this?
I'd like to go over with her, sir.
You can't.
But you can't possibly have naval crews for all the boats coming in. Now, I know my own boat, sir. Nobody better.
Don't be a fool. It's no place for civilians over there.
Nevertheless, I'd like to go. I expect some of you feel the same.
Yeah, yeah, I would.
That's Charles Foreman, a journalist who has been unwilling to accept the government's standard line on what is going on over in France.
Well, I don't get it. Here are the biggest troop movements since the war broke out. Nobody says anything. Nobody attempts anything. Nobody knows anything. What do they think they're there for? Maneuvers? Patrol activity. Other bilge.
Now, taking his boat, the Vanity, over to Dunkirk, he'll see for himself just how much his sources were downplaying the severity of the situation.
Everybody's saying that war was so damnable it couldn't happen again, shoving our heads in the sand like a lot of ostriches. Well, the Germans didn't think that way.
Charles behaves a little bit like a man who's been magically gifted with the hindsight of 1958, lecturing everyone around him that it's not 1918 anymore.
No, you can't blame the army. They had what we gave them, last war weapons, last war methods. This is the result.
That the Nazis don't fight phony wars.
Yes, it is a lovely war. The war's a blasted phony anyway.
But the man puts his money where his mouth is. He leavens his holier-than-thou pomposity with true heroism. There he is now, on the beach of Dunkirk, everyone in disbelief that a civvy came all the way out here. His boat, the Vanity, is at the bottom of the channel now. He's waiting for a ride home with Tubby, the reluctant corporal.
I never thought I'd see a sight like this.
Us neither, sir.
What a mess. What a shambles we've made of this whole rotten affair.
Maybe Clem Miniver could give them a ride back to Blighty. He's been out here back and forth for 5 days now. He's haggard and exhausted, his face all 5 o'clock shadow. But he's proud.
And come to think of it, I'm a bit proud of myself. What you might call a real bit of navigation. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Just one more run, then back home to his wife Kay and the little ones. At least Kay is safe back in Belem, with nothing to worry about other than the upcoming flower show. The kindly old station master, Mr. Ballard, is putting a stunning rose into competition that's named after her, the Mrs. Miniver. Oh, Belem. How Clem wishes he were safe and cozy there. He'll say as much when he finally gets home.
Oh, darling, I'm almost sorry for you, having such a nice, quiet, peaceful time when things were really happening. But that's what men are for, isn't it? Go out and do things while you women folk look after the house.
Yes, dear. Come in.
But he's wrong.
I'm sorry, Mum, but I just remembered we ain't got any ham.
What?
He'd give it all to that German pilot.
That German pilot? The one that crashed in the area a few days ago? The one that everyone's been searching for? Kay Miniver finds him early one morning in the garden, and he rushes her inside at gunpoint.
Move, or make noise. I shoot.
The children are asleep upstairs.
Food.
He wants food.
Drink.
And milk.
What?
Milk. He's just a child himself. And he's hurt. Just as badly as Robbie Turner is over at Dunkirk. He can barely stay standing.
You'll be wonderfully looked after in hospital. You'll be safe there. The war won't last forever.
No. soon we finish it.
But where Robbie is single-mindedly focused only on getting home, on living out his days in a beach cottage with Cecilia, Mrs. Miniver's German soldier dreams solely of one thing.
We will come. We will bomb your cities. Like Barcelona, Warsaw, Narvik, Rotterdam.
Destruction.
30,000 in 2 hours. And we will do the same thing here. You've got no information, Eile!
Somewhere up amidst the clouds, between Belem and Dunkirk, between Kay and Clem Miniver, their oldest, Vin Miniver, is shooting at Nazis like this one. True believers. Vin is so young. He uses his engine to signal to his worried mother every time he passes over Belem.
It's Vin, Clem, it's Vin!
And he's in love with Carol Belden. They'll be married soon after Carol's rich grandmother finally concedes to the union, gets past her completely warranted fear that their time together may be dreadfully short.
My marriage only lasted a few weeks. My husband was in the army. He was killed in action.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Forgive me. I didn't know.
I never regretted it. Not for one moment. We married because we knew that might happen. But I don't want Carol to suffer as I suffered.
Don't you want her to be happy, even for a little while?
Carol Belden, bless her, does not see the world through rose-colored glasses. She knows. She knows. Her marriage may not be a long one.
I'm not afraid to face the truth. Are you?
No.
I love him, but I know. I know that I may lose him. He's young and he loves life, but he may die. Let me say it. He may be killed. Any day, any hour.
But Vin and Carol persist. Chin up. Vin has to go again. He's needed in the skies. Not a lot of Spitfires and Hurricanes up there in the skies. At least, not that the men on the beach can see.
Doesn't Jerry ever let up?
What's to stop him? A squadron or two of your blokes, mate. Where are they?
Sleeping it off. Sky's full of this wine.
Well, where is the
airport? We never seen it.
Ah, they got no guts.
There will be that wondrous moment where Farrier glides past the beach after shooting down a Nazi, out of fuel but full of style. But most men in the British Expeditionary Force will wonder what that one soldier gripes later on when he sees Collins, Farrier's buddy, who gets shot down over the channel. Where were you guys?
I haven't seen my aircraft, not that we could recognize, for 3 days.
It's blasted wicked, son, and you know it. We only had 4 fighter squadrons in the forward area. What do they expect to get over here? There are only about 3 airfields in England that can send fighters this distance.
I said I know, but they don't, and there's a lot like them.
Where were you guys? Well, where they weren't was France. As soon as the Germans broke through the line at Sedan.
Ils sont à Sedan.
For the benefit of the uneducated among us, I shall translate.
Tacham can't believe the Sedan's fallen. I can.
The RAF had flown away.
It's no use. They'll be here in half an hour. We must leave immediately.
Yes, let's get the hell out of it.
Just in the nick of time, too.
If the home defense is drained away in desperate attempts to remedy the situation in France, defeat in France will involve the final, complete, and irremediable defeat of this country. I have the honor to be, sir, your obedient servant, H.C.T. Downing.
Air Chief Marshal Hugh Downing made it official over the objections of the new Prime Minister.
You do realize, Downing, the position this puts us in? I realize that the French have been promised these squadrons by Churchill personally. He's given the French Prime Minister his word. You do appreciate, Downing, that Churchill will have to see this. That's why I wrote it.
Winston Churchill has been Prime Minister for less than a month. And by the looks of it, he may not be Prime Minister for much longer, especially if he can't get his very popular, very powerful Foreign Minister, Lord Halifax, to stop talking about making peace with the Germans.
We're facing certain defeat on land, the annihilation of our army, and imminent invasion. We must negotiate peace talks.
When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
Nonsense. The only slippery slope.
Would you stop interrupting me while I am interrupting you?
Churchill has got to keep the French in the fight somehow, which is going to be quite a task, as our journalist Charles Forman found out a few days back.
We have lost the battle. Don't be a fool. They have broken through.
What?
Look, it can't be as bad as all that. You don't understand. You are an Englishman. It is France that is being torn. It is my country. You English, you can never understand. You have never known what it is to have a German in your home.
The French feel defeated. According to French Premier Paul Reynaud, they are defeated.
It is the one virtue that we French have left. We are realists. This battle is lost.
Reynaud begs Churchill for support from the RAF. It's their only hope. Churchill hopes he can secure some support for his French allies. The skies have looked pretty empty. But wait. There is something in the sky. Is that a goose? White as snow, this majestic creature flies over a small boat like it's guarding it. The boat. Yeah, that's a hunchback with a claw hand holding the rope for the sail in his teeth. The snow goose, La Princesse Pardue, soars overhead like an avenging angel, a beacon of hope to all the men who that hunchback, Philip Riadar, saves on his many trips back and forth across the English Channel. Back at Riadar's lighthouse, Fritha frets, knowing that the sensitive artist, Riadar, won't be back. She's been afraid of him since she was 12. Maybe in love with him too, much more recently. She begged him not to go.
Men are huddled on the beaches like hunted birds, Frith. Like the wounded and hunted birds we used to find and bring to sanctuary. Over them fly the steel peregrines, hawks and gyre falcons. And they have no shelter from these iron birds of prey. They are lost and storm-driven. And harried like the Princess Perdue, you found and brought to me out of the marshes many years ago, and we healed her. They need help, my dear, as our wild creatures have needed help, and that is why I must go. It is something that I can do. Yes, I can. For once, I can be a man and play my part.
Days later, the goose returns to the marshes, to Fritha, circling over her. And Philip does not. Or does he?
Frith, 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 my love. Goodbye, my love.
The white pinions, black-tipped, were beating it out upon her heart, and her answering,
Philip, I love thee.
Frith saw no longer the snow goose, but the soul of Riadar, taking farewell of her, departing forever.
Godspeed. Godspeed, Philip.
Godspeed, everyone. Death is everywhere. The little boats of Dunkirk are pockmarked with heartbreaking fatalities. On Mr. Dawson's boat, the shell-shocked soldier accidentally kills George, the young boat hand who just wanted to do something notable enough that he'd end up in the local paper.
I'll be useful, sir.
The journalist, Charles Forman, who was so certain that the British had been downplaying the severity of their situation, was proven right in the worst possible way. He shot Billy Praise during Sunday parade.
Get to the boat, Frankie.
tell Holden. Tell my wife.
Shockingly, of all people, Vin Miniver survives. Everyone in Bellum is dreading the day when Vin doesn't come home, and the lovely Carol Belden is heartbroken, left only with the memories of their all-too-brief relationship. But Vin Miniver makes it back. Clem makes it back. Kay survives her ordeal with the German pilot. Vin and Carol are married. They honeymoon in Scotland. As if this weren't rapturous enough, Mr. Ballard's rose, the Mrs. Miniver, takes the prize at the flower show.
But if I had to lose, there's no man I'd sooner lose to than James Ballard, because he's a man of spirit, and I like a man of spirit.
Could Britain be a better place? And then...
Can I get you something? Glass. What?
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, into the Battle of Britain and the Blitz. But I feel like you should know that it doesn't all work out for Vin and Carol. You probably guessed that. Her speech earlier pretty much guaranteed that either she or Vin would die. And it probably wouldn't be Vin. You've been prepared for this moment. She was too perfect for this world. Young, beautiful, kind. The ideal martyr. The next morning, the town of Bellum congregates at the church, which is missing a few walls and a chunk of the roof.
We, in this quiet corner of England, have suffered the loss of friends very dear to us.
Carol isn't the only one missing from the congregation.
James Ballard, station master and bell ringer, and the proud winner only an hour before his death of the Belden Cup for his beautiful Miniver Rose.
We're almost done with our tapestry. Maybe this is the most powerful thread of all, the one we should call special attention to. More than any other film we've brought up, Mrs. Miniver feels strangely artificial. Possibly because it was pretty much a contemporary film, made in 1941, meaning it doesn't know a lot of what we know in hindsight. Probably because, unlike every other film here, it was made so far away, in Hollywood, with some of the cast affecting British accents, and with Walter Pigeon as Clem Miniver not even really trying.
All right with you, Nobby?
Aye, sir.
Turn over.
But this speech at the end is so pointed, it's weaponized.
Why, in all conscience, should these be the ones to suffer? Children, old people, a young girl at the height of her loveliness. Why these? Are these our soldiers? Are these our fighters?
Roosevelt thought so. After Pearl Harbor, he insisted that Mrs. Miniver be rushed into theaters. Legend has it that Churchill said Mrs. Miniver was worth 6 divisions. And also, worth 100 battleships. The man delivering this speech is the British actor Henry Wilcoxon. We've heard him before on Iconography. 7 years before Mrs. Miniver, he played Richard the Lionheart in The Crusades. All swaggering in and conquest and victory.
I know the feel of a lance in my hand. I know what it is to see men go down before me.
His vicar in Mrs. Miniver is a much gentler soul, but some of that lion-hearted righteousness shines through here.
Why should they be sacrificed? I shall tell you why. Because this is not only a war of soldiers in uniform. It is a war of the people, of all the people. And it must be fought not only on the battlefield, but in the cities and in the villages, in the factories and on the farms, in the home and in the heart of every man, woman, and child who loves freedom.
Fact is, Wilcoxon didn't just deliver this speech. The night before filming, he and director William Wyler wrote and rewrote it, each with a major personal stake in this story. Wyler, a French Jew with family still in Europe, Henry Wilcoxon mourning his brother Robert, who had died evacuating men from Dunkirk. The real Dunkirk.
Well,
We have buried our dead, but we shall not forget them.
Get in real close and you can see that here, a hole has been punched through our tapestry and we can see through to the reality underneath. We could end our tapestry there. What a rousing note to go out on, but let's push just a bit farther. How far does our tapestry of Dunkirk stretch? Do we weave our last when Churchill gives his own rousing speech to Parliament on June 10th?
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds.
Or maybe we end it where Christopher Nolan does, the following day, with Tommy reading that speech aloud as cheering civilians pass him and his friend beer and food through the windows of the train.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. Never surrender.
Or how about where the 1967 epic The Battle of Britain rolls its opening credits, panning over the evacuated Dunkirk beach, strewn with destroyed machines as the Germans finish their conquest of northern France, and a BBC announcer opens the next chapter of World War II.
In the House of Commons this afternoon, the Prime Minister, Mr. Churchill, said, "What General Vegar called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin."
I think we go a bit further to the first stories about the story within stories. The first Dunkirk movie, the one a plucky team of propagandists make about the Starling sisters. Remember the twins whose boat broke down?
Twin sisters took their father's cockle boat over to join the rescue, came back with a deck full of soldiers. It's everything the ministry are after.
Authenticity and optimism.
Contradiction in terms, if you ask me, but this could be a bloody good story.
And the first Dunkirk novel, the one that Brian Italis was writing late at night at St. Thomas's Hospital, the one about Robbie and Cecilia.
Brian Italis, I'd like to talk now about your new novel, Atonement.
The movie comes out in late 1940, during the darkest hour, when Britain stands alone, withstanding constant bombing raids. Produced by the Ministry of Information, The Nancy Starling was written by Tom Buckley, Raymond Parfitt, and, in her first serious writing job, a young Welsh woman, Catherine Cole.
Welcome to the Ministry of Information Film Division.
If you're wondering how these three writers turned the sad story of two abused teenagers stealing a boat only to break down just off the coast and get towed back in into a rousing propaganda film, I mean, come on, they lied. First, Catherine lied, saying the sisters made it to Dunkirk and back, even though she knew they hadn't. She did it to keep her job. And then, when her egregious lie was exposed, well, the team of writers doubled down. They made a three-act structure out of mist. They invented characters, motives, situations. An abusive father becomes a humorous drunk uncle who redeems himself when he dies heroically while fixing the engine.
What if it's not the engine? What if it's the propeller?
Okay, not the engine. The propeller.
The propeller, Snow. If I can just cut it free.
A soldier boyfriend, Johnny, is assembled out of imagination particles.
Johnny Lamb, Kent, England.
That looks like fun, the Secretary of War says, and he gets in on the action.
Brannigan, made in America, and not for export.
So what are you doing here?
Trying to get back.
Put an American in there, too, he insists, so we can convince those Yanks to get over here and help. But there weren't any Americans at Dunkirk, the writers protest. Well, now there were. There was, in fact, a handsome blonde journalist who doesn't say a lot because the pilot they got to play him can't act.
William. Archie. My boys.
A love triangle. Dramatic last words before someone dies.
Such an age. You've been gone.
It's nonsense. It's frippery. Love isn't that geometric. Death isn't that convenient. Catherine and Buckley fall in love. And it's sloppy. Writers through and through, they each try and write their romance, give it beats and acts and symbolism. But you can't write life. If you could, if their courtship were the kind of wartime tragedy romance that they're in the act of writing, Buckley would get called up, or Katrin would get caught in a bombing raid. Everyone in the audience would have time to process the tragedy, appreciate the dramatic irony. But no, in a world where German bombs drop every night and conscription looms for every young man, Katrin and Buckley's blossoming romance is destroyed by a freak accident in the studio. Dramatic irony, happy endings. It's nonsense. But nonsense works. Katrin goes to a showing of her film, The Nancy Starling, and she's floored by the effect it has on those around her. They've come to see it over and over again. They know the lines by heart, and they recite them through sobs. What's on that screen isn't true to what happened to the Starling sisters. It isn't true to what happened at Dunkirk. But it is true in some magical way that connects with people. Reinvigorated, Katrin Cole gets to work on writing her next movie. Maybe later in her career, Katrin got to know Bryony Tallis. Maybe they traveled in the same circles, Katrin, the brassy screenwriter, Bryony, the quiet novelist. Bryony may have been writing the story of Cecilia and Robbie in 1940, but that book didn't come out in 1940. Or in the 1940s at all. It didn't come out for over 50 years. Bryony labored on her book Atonement until she could labor no more.
It's your 21st novel.
My last novel.
Oh, really? Are you retiring?
I'm dying. My doctor tells me I have something called vascular dementia.
There's so much catharsis in those 6 decades of writing. Robbie and Cecilia reunite, and when Bryony visits them to admit her error, they do not hold back. They really let her have it. It's satisfying on 2 levels. Satisfying to see Robbie and Cecilia together at last, and doubly satisfying to see Bryony take her lumps. It's almost too satisfying.
In fact, I was too much of a coward to go and see my sister in June 1940. I never made that journey to Bali. So the scene in which I confess to them is imagined, invented. And in fact, could never have happened. Because Robbie Turner died of septicemia at Bray Dunes on June the 1st, 1940, the last day of the evacuation.
Yeah. If I didn't bring up Robbie Turner in the roll call of the dead from earlier, it's because I got the story from Bryony. She rewrote history. Maybe you're aghast. You should be a little bit. But just, I mean, we gave Katrin Cole a pass for lying about the Starling sisters because the people in the theater loved the movie so much. Maybe let's just hear Bryony out.
I had for a very long time decided to tell the absolute truth. No rhymes, no embellishments. I got first-hand accounts of all the events I didn't personally witness. The conditions in prison, the evacuation to Dunkirk, everything. But the effect of all this honesty was rather pitiless, you see. I couldn't any longer imagine what purpose would be served by it.
By what, sorry, served by honesty?
By honesty. Or reality. What sense of hope or satisfaction could a reader derive from an ending like that? So in the book, I wanted to give Robbie and Cecilia what they lost out on in life. I'd like to think this isn't weakness or evasion, but a final act of kindness. I gave them their happiness.
There it is, the end of our Tapestry of Dunkirk. I hope you noticed some recurring themes. In stories about Dunkirk, death doesn't go for the expected target. It doesn't generally come for the soldier or the pilot. There should be this feeling of the rug being pulled out from under you. This is most dramatic in Atonement, of course, where everything builds to a shocking reveal that the climax was a lie. We see Robbie alive, back in England. Our own understanding of film grammar is used against us. But that feeling is elsewhere, too. In Nolan's film, we expect death to come on the beach, courtesy of a Messerschmitt. But it happens miles away, in calm waters, on Mr. Dawson's boat, this world of cozy turtleneck sweaters. In 1958's Dunkirk, Charles Forman's own cozy sweater reassures us that even though he's in this really dangerous war zone, he can't get hurt. He's our point of view character, not a soldier. They pull a similar trick in Their Finest. Death comes out of nowhere, where we least expect it. And then, of course, there's Mrs. Miniver, maybe the most effective of these films, the ending of which I really should have reacquainted myself with before I showed it to my wife. That did not go well. That ending of Mrs. Miniver is a perfect subversion of expectations, escalated and escalated a little more until everyone in that audience wants to defeat every Nazi. It should be Vin Miniver, right? He signed up after all. But it's Carol. And if you were prepared for that, there was foreshadowing, you know. You weren't prepared. You couldn't possibly be prepared for the off-screen death of Mr. Ballard.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Every death I've mentioned, other than Robbie's, was a civilian death. Every Dunkirk film takes its cue from that Mrs. Miniver speech. The line between the front and the home front is blurred as civilians charge toward the front line and become the heroes. And the soldiers they're saving, every one of them is helpless. Every one of them, you might have noticed, is separated from their unit. Dunkirk as a story space is such a powerful subversion of expectations because it's a soldier's defeat and a civilian's victory. Accordingly, it's in every story's best interest to downplay or ignore some of the facts, like the fact that plenty of military ships didn't get sunk and made it back with thousands of soldiers, and that most of the conscripted civilian ships were industrial ships and merchant ships, ferries, big honkin' ships, and that most of the small ships were taken to Dunkirk by Navy men and not their owners. You have to ignore that. The money shot of any Dunkirk movie is of umpteen extras on fishing boats staring resolutely ahead at that moment when they could turn back and don't. That's the Dunkirk spirit. Ordinary citizens going out and finding the war via the miracle of Dunkirk, and the war finding ordinary citizens via the subsequent Blitz. It's a very particular cocktail that has no direct American equivalent. It's not the same as support your troops. It's the idea that at any moment, you could become a troop. As the captain of a conscripted ship, as an air raid warden, as a nurse. And when it happens, you step up. You don't complain. You do what needs to be done to survive. And when you're done, you have tea. It's about the everyday heroism of being a citizen of the only country on Earth that's still fighting Hitler, and that somehow isn't losing. Or isn't losing that badly. It's fighting on together, while utterly alone. That alone part is really important. The British take pride in having been routed so thoroughly in the Battle of France, and persisting. When their allies, the Norwegians, the Dutch, the Belgians, and devastatingly the French, crumbled in mere days, the people of Britain kept calm and carried on. This minuscule island held out against the blitz of a continent-swallowing behemoth.
The Navy has earned our undying gratitude. The army is undefeated. Courage has brought them through unconquered, their spirit unbowed. This is the epic of Dunkirk, a name that will live forever in the annals of warfare.
Can we just say, this is a story too. It's the story of Churchill's famous history of the war and of many early World War II historians. It's also part of the tapestry of Dunkirk. There's a lot of truth in it. It sticks out of the tapestry a bit further. It feels real. But there's so much reality it ignores. There's the Empire, of course. Britain wasn't a minuscule island in 1940. And it ignores the bravery of the Belgians and the French. Yeah, this story, it's still flat. Not the lived experience of the Allied forces in 1940, but a very persuasive bedtime story about the magic that can happen when you're on your own.
I'll never forget.
It's been a persuasive story.
Versions of the war swirled around the EU referendum last year, as they must do, it seems, whenever Britain considers Europe. The subsequent vote was determined by other factors, but it's hard to dissociate the mix of English nationalism, dislike of European governments, and the fear of immigrants. That references to the Second World War came readily, if unfortunately to the ministers charged with making Brexit a success, shows just how natural the associations are. An underprepared civil service coped with World War II, they can easily cope with this, said David Davis. The reference was significant. Most of those reaching back to the war are remembering not the conflict, but a mediated version of it, first produced for the big screen between the 1940s and the 1960s, and repeatedly broadcast on television in the decades that followed. This is the memory of a repeat of a fiction, and all the more powerful for the simplification it has undergone.
That's historian Daniel Todman in an article headlined, Drunk on Dunkirk Spirit, the Brexiteers are setting sail for a dangerous future. We'll hear a good deal from Todman next episode when we desimplify the Dunkirk spirit and look at what really happened in May and June 1940.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day.